From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
The long-anticipated meeting between the President of the United States and the President of the Russian Federation took place Friday in Hamburg, Germany.
President Putin and I have been discussing various things, and I think it's going very well. We've had some very, very good talks.
President Trump's optimism was shared by the Russian president.
I'm delighted to be able to meet you personally, Mr. President, and I hope, as you have said, our meeting will yield positive results.
For more on all that, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer in international affairs at Moscow State University.
Yeah, we've just had the first Trump-Putin face-to-face meeting. It was built up in the press to an unprecedented degree of hysteria and speculation. There was speculation from the Daily Beast that the master manipulator Putin would roll the sociopathic, narcissistic, egotistic Trump easily, and there were countless speculation about the innate Russian genetic predisposition, almost genetic, according to the director of national intelligence, James Clapper, to manipulate and deceive. And there was even leaks from the administration that the deep state embeds in Trump's cabinet, McMaster's and others, tried to force that Trump would accept Fiona Hill, who is now an administration official dealing with Russian matters, in this meeting. She would be there to hold Trump's hand or hold the leash, hold the leash that was attached to him, depending on what you like, because they were afraid that Trump might, I don't know, respond too familiarly or be too friendly with Putin, or that Putin would use his mind control powers on Trump or something. That was the speculation. Anyway, Trump managed to arrange the meeting without anyone babysitting him in attendance. It was him and Putin, Secretaries of State Tillerson and Foreign Ministry Lavrov, and two translators, and that's what the meeting took place. They were scheduled for 35 minutes. They went for 2 hours and 16 minutes. There was several handshakes between them on the sides of the G20 in Hamburg, where they are meeting beforehand. And as soon as the handshake pictures came out, the media, the internet, social media, Western journalists and commentariat were filled with an absolute torrent of half-baked pop psychology body language analysis, I guess having nothing else to report on. This is the new Kremlinology of our world today. Reading, deciphering Donald Trump's handshakes with other world leaders. That is the new Kremlinology. That's what a sad state journalism is in today. It says far more about the journalists than it does about Trump or his handshakes or his meetings with any foreign leaders. That's the real psychology of it. But this was much hyped up. Supposedly the U.S. had very little preparation going into this. McMaster's was said to have said that they'll talk about whatever the president wants to talk about with, which I guess was a little confusing to the Russian side, because they are a little more used to having a specific list of policy issues to discuss, their positions on it, compromises and concessions they're willing to make at various stages, cross purposes. They prepare for these things. And it seems that was somewhat in absence on the American side. There were leaks from the National Security Council in the week that Trump was asking for deliverables, things that he could give Trump, or things that he could give Putin that would break the impasse in relations and sweeten. And there was speculation that he may give back two diplomatic properties, which Obama seized from Russia in the U.S. They're referred to as diplomatic dachas, where Russian embassy staff and their families would basically relax in the U.S. And these were seized with just 24 hours notice by the Obama administration at the end of last year, and something that Russia responded at least rhetorically very negatively, although in the end, with Trump taking office, they chose not to not to respond with any kind of tit for tat proposal, although they have kept that option open and they are still considering it, evidently. So immediately after this meeting, and like I said, it was only supposed to be a half an hour. Trump's aides, many of them only wanted supposedly what is referred to as a set aside, meaning they would meet on the sides of the G20 without any formal arrangements or anything, and it would be a short meeting. Evidently, Trump insisted on having a full bilateral meeting, and it has just clocked in at 2 hours and 16 minutes, which from the liberal media and commentariat has resulted in no end of dread and speculation about what evils might have been cooked up between them. The most immediate results coming out of it is that as soon as it was announced the meeting was over, there were announcements from U.S. officials that they have reached a ceasefire deal with Russia, and one must suppose with the Syrian government, in southwest Syria, specifically in southwest Syria. Now, the Syrian government, the Syrian Arab Army, announced earlier this week a unilateral ceasefire of their own in southwest Syria. And it's rather interesting about the specific location where this takes place. This is not where the incidents where the U.S. has repeatedly fired on Syrian government troops and shot down a Syrian airplane. That was in southeast Syria, around Al-Tanf base that the U.S. has set up in southeast Syria, at the right at the Jordanian-Iraqi-Syrian border, inside Syrian territory, where they were training militants there, supposedly for the fight against ISIS. You know, another attempt to manufacture moderate Sunni proxies in Syria. By all accounts, when that base was cut off and boxed in by a kind of a Hail Mary move by the Syrian army that reached, rather than confronted directly, just spun around it and reached the Iraqi border and effectively cut them off from moving any further north into Deir ez-Zor. Supposedly, the U.S. has airlifted that small number of militants there into the north, into the Kurdish-controlled areas where the U.S.'s Kurdish proxies, the Syrian Democratic Forces, and a few scattered Arab tribes are located. That's at al-Shadadab. And that should be interesting, because there is no love lost between these Sunni proxies and the Kurdish proxies, the SDF. So I don't know how much actual use they'll be there, and no one knows what their numbers are, but they're reported to be small. But this deal is supposedly in southwest Syria. And what has happened there is literally, again, al-Qaeda. This is literally al-Qaeda and friends in another al-Qaeda umbrella. But it is still referred to somehow as the opposition or rebels in most of the Western press. If pressed, experts will acknowledge that it's largely al-Qaeda or operating under its latest incarnation, HTS, Tahrir al-Sham. They have been attacking the Syrian government in the south near Daraa. And they have repeatedly received what is de facto close air support from Israel.
Right.
There's a standard procedure now. Al-Qaeda, whenever they need air support, they just lob a mortar shell across the border into, well, it's not really a border. It's into Israeli-occupied Golan Heights down there.
Right.
And then Israel says, oh, the conflict has spilled across our borders, and we will strike back at the Syrian army.
Right.
And that this has happened so many times already that it's already a standard procedure. It's even, I guess, joked about, though it is no joking matter. Every one of these, and there have been many of them so far, is a attack. It is an act of war on a sovereign country.
And accidentally, coincidentally coordinate with the ground activity conducted by Al-Qaeda. And they feel so guilty that they feel obliged to offer medical assistance to anyone who gets wounded in Al-Qaeda's ranks.
Yeah, this is all very interesting because this has been reported behind the scenes and quietly by the Israeli press for a long time.
Yeah,
but just
rich,
in the past week, they have actually been pushing this story themselves, and there was actually quite a few articles in the Wall Street Journal and everywhere acknowledging where Israel was being quite frank, saying, actually, we've been providing a lot of support for the rebels all along, which in the alternate media we have been talking about for a long time, and it was published in Israeli newspapers, but the U.S. press never really acknowledged. So the only reason they would do that is if they intended to get more involved. And sure enough, it was in the past 10 days, there were at least five occasions where the Israeli Air Force attacked the Syrian government in such situations. As far as I know, most of the time, those shots could have been fired from outside Syrian airspace. That's within the range of them there. So they could have been fired from occupied Golan Heights or elsewhere in Syria or perhaps even over Lebanon. But there was no response from Russia, from the Syrian air defense, from the Russian air defense in the area. Russia has reached some kind of agreement with Syria. They obviously weren't happy about the strikes, but they didn't try to shoot anything down wherever it was located. So the Syrian army just a few days ago declared a unilateral ceasefire in this area. I don't know what good a unilateral ceasefire is when you are fighting an Al-Qaeda umbrellaed insurgency, whether they will respond in kind. But now, supposedly out of this meeting, we have a U.S.-Russia ceasefire agreement for this specific area, I guess building on that Syrian government unilaterally declared ceasefire. And supposedly, Jordan and Israel are both part of this deal. So this was obviously had some kind of prearrangement for.
Right.
So for all the analysts, including myself, that thought that nothing policy-wise was going to come out of this meeting, this has. And it seems like there was some preparation for it. Earlier in the day, the Israeli press also leaked, but they made a statement that Israel did not want to see Russian troops or Russian Air Force patrolling any no-fly zones or deconfliction zones in southwest Syria, that they wanted to see American troops there. Now, we don't know whether that's actually the case. To have American troops officially as part of a ceasefire agreement patrolling an area of Syria is kind of insane enough. But in order to do so, they would then have to babysit, again, literally Al-Qaeda, and maintain the pretense that Al-Qaeda and its friends were some type of moderate opposition, which would be no end of trouble for them as well. Because, despite the looking the other way and the supplying the friends of my enemies that's been going on, Al-Qaeda has no love lost for U.S. military troops.
Right. And, the other side of it is this, too. You've got not just that, but you have to have the assent of the expressed assent of the Syrian government to the U.S. being there for this to have any international legitimacy, because it's otherwise facially illegal.
We can only assume that the Syrian government has already acquiesced to that, to Russia's bargaining on that behalf. It would surprise me if it were not so. A bigger question is whether Iran has agreed to this, and whether they would, how they would view on Russia signing a separate ceasefire agreement with the United States.
Right.
And it has to be noted that this is happening outside of the Astana process, outside of even the Geneva process, not that that ever resulted in anything. Right. The Astana process is the agreement with Russia, Turkey, and Iran, which Russia and Iran have agreed to with Turkey to try to cut Qatar and Saudi and the U.S. out of any final settlement, because they can't very well supply their proxies without the Turkish border, through which all the supplies have gone to Idlib and everywhere else in Syria all along.
Right.
So that was the reason for the Astana. But this ceasefire evidently is happening outside of the Astana process, reached between Russia and the U.S., and I guess behind the U.S. side must be Israel and Jordan, and God knows what Saudi Arabia and Qatar busy fighting each other their feelings on this are, and at least in proxy form, Al Qaeda, they're representing Al Qaeda in this, and various other, of the 31 flavors of jihad down there.
Right.
And on the Russian side, the Syrian government, Iran, Hezbollah, and even Iraq.
Iraq's foreign minister, for example, just in the last 24 hours is, stating overtly, concern about the possibility of an independent Kurdistan, as if somebody had just raised that in a back room somewhere, either as a threat or as a proposal, somebody with juice like the U.S.
Well, everyone, again, there is no, most of the countries in the region have a Kurdish minority, not just Syria, but Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and others. Mm. And none of them want an independent Kurdistan the Kurds in Iraq, long protected as a de facto state by the United States. And we're talking, the Barzani clans here that are allied with Turkey and actually opposed and fighting with the PKK, the YPG, the Kurds from Syria and Turkey. The U.S. has been supporting them there, and they have announced an intention to have an independence referendum, which I haven't seen that anyone has agreed to.
And that's what the foreign minister was talking about specifically, was this would be a catastrophe, basically.
Yes. This is it's really interesting because, there has been a lot of speculation, including by me, about the U.S., whether they intended, failing at regime change, to partition East Syria. And as I've long said, there's no Sunni moderate force that they can use to do it, and the Kurds just don't present a viable partition partner because no one in the region wants an independent Kurdistan.
There'll be partition in everybody. That's why you make the first slice, they're going to be cutting out a whole cake.
At the very least, Syria is probably looking at having to accept some form of federalism or autonomy devolved to Kurdistan. They already de facto have it now.
Yeah.
But the U.S. announced this week that they are building 7 military bases, some of them already built, some of them under construction now, in that Kurdish held region of northeast Syria. Which means the Americans aren't planning to go anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting, but again, I don't think that they have any grounds for creating a truly independent state there, because their own allies, supposedly Turkey, a NATO member, and Iraq, would never accept that. At the same time, there's been a lot of noise out of Turkey about troops moving into their area of occupied Syria in north central Syria, north of Aleppo, and that they were going to attack the western Kurdish canton at its capital, Afrin. They were bombing it with artillery for a good 2 weeks now, and supposedly large numbers of troops and tanks were moving in. And I guess in an attempt to forestall that, there has been announcement on pro-Syrian media just in the last 24 hours that a deal has been reached whereby the Kurds in Afrin would turn Afrin over to the Syrian government. One must presume that that is in order to prevent a Turkish attack on Afrin. which is an interesting development.
Yeah.
And further side that, you know, of the complicated nature of this conflict, where the Kurds have fought the U.S.-backed rebels, they fought ISIS, they fight Turkey, but they have never fought the Syrian government, although they certainly are in this game to get the maximum amount of autonomy and leverage for their own people as they can out of this. They play both, all three or four sides, depending on how many you're looking at,
right,
against each other.
Yeah,
and
gears.
Again, the Kurds, even in Syria, are not a monolith. The Kurds in Western Syria have been more supported by Russia and the Syrian government, while the Kurds in Eastern Syria, the SDF, have been more supported by the U.S.
That's so
very
interesting. I mean, yeah, because you've got
so many contradictions in this conflict, so many on all sides.
Yeah,
but
the Western
on U.S. policy.
I mean, the Western part is the most remote for Russia on the one hand, and the Eastern part the closest to Iran, although it's also right next to Iraq. It's contiguous to Iraq, and so it's it's not just moving parts. It's like looking at like six or seven gears in some kind of a Rube Goldberg machine spinning as you look at all these things develop. All right, so we've got. You've got Turkey, Iran, the Saudis, the whole thing between the Saudis and the Qataris and all of that, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Iraq, I don't know who else, al-Sisi. We haven't even mentioned Egypt in this.
Yeah, they've been kind of bit players, but they have at least rhetorically provided support for the Russia and the Syrian government and all of this.
Yeah.
But it is definitely a regional conflagration. I mean, this has gone well beyond the borders of Syria, and it has pulled in Russia and the U.S. Into what is at some level a Syrian civil war, at some level a regional jihad, at some level an Iranian-Saudi proxy conflict, and at some level a Russian U.S. proxy conflict. You could almost call it a world war at this point. It's happening there. And if you really want to understand it, we're talking about a lot of locations. Just pull up a map. You need maps to do this. Sorry, we can't help you on radio. Go to the Moon of Alabama blog or Six Semper Tyrannus. They have some excellent maps up. Or Al Mazdar News, which is a Lebanese pro-Syrian government source. They always have excellent maps that you can really then take a look at what we're talking about and understand where everything is happening, because it is a complicated, very tight, tense situation with a lot of different players involved and a lot of contradictory sides and forces.
Yeah. And all right, so we have all of that happening. Let's back out a little bit and look at the grand chessboard, to quote the, thank God he's lit, the late Zbigniew Brzezinski. Grand chessboard is you have a lot of the pieces, on the board right now in Hamburg. And so they aren't talking definitely about this because an agreement, the framework of an agreement has been leaked as to this, what we've been discussing.
Certainly very vague details.
Yeah. And they were certainly discussing other things too, at least saying, okay, the most important thing we have to talk about is what's going on in and around Syria, so let's focus for 2 hours on that, but that fits in a big picture. What's some of the other things going on?
Yeah, first of all, let me just say that I am not optimistic about this ceasefire. We've seen every previous ceasefire that was agreed to with the U.S., there was one last year with Obama, have all collapsed. Some of it seemingly at the instigation of the Pentagon itself when they fired on Syrian government forces.
A couple times now, too.
I'm not optimistic about this ceasefire. The details have not been released yet. U.S. troops babysitting al-Qaeda in southern Syria under Israeli air cover. It all seems very, very suspicious and very far-fetched to me, but we'll see. But supposedly, also out of the meeting, there was a brief statement by Putin as he then went into a meeting with Shinzo Abe of Japan that they also talked Ukraine, they talked Syria, and they talked cybersecurity and terrorism and other bilateral issues. He didn't go into any details there, but certainly missile defense, I'm sure, was brought up as well as the U.S. seeming they're making noise about pulling out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. That would be a big concern to Russia. And the Western press has been harping that Trump should bring up the question of the allegations of Russia interfering in the elections, and that Trump should say something about this. I can't imagine what that would actually amount to. My people are telling me that you helped me get elected. Don't you do that again.
Yeah, right. I know.
I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall, as I imagine everyone would.
Yeah, yeah.
And if there's any indication from what has gone on previously with every meeting between Lavrov and Trump, and Trump and anyone else in the White House, I would expect that this meeting was bugged by the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, and we'll probably get a transcript and readout of it released by anonymous current or former officials in the Washington Post within a few days at the most.
Right.
So we may actually get to find out what they said. But we'll see about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a busy day for sure. And he met, by the way, with Peña Nieto of Mexico also, which is an interesting.
Yes, yes, he also met with Erdogan of Turkey, which is no one's friend at this point.
I know, poor guy.
Even as the EU is talking openly about finally canceling the Turkish accession agreement to the EU, which was never going to happen anyway.
Right.
There was a lot going on at this summit. Certainly the Putin-Trump meeting was the biggest one. I think the Putin-he meeting that occurred earlier, before both of them came to Hamburg for the G20 summit, that was also very important. They reiterated, they signed another $10 billion worth of agreements on the Eurasian Economic Union, conjunction with the One China, the One Road, Silk Road Project, One Belt, One Road Project.
Yeah.
And they reiterated that they are the closest
partners.
Partners, personal friends, that the relations have never been better together. And they also came out with a joint position and a diplomatic solution to North Korea, where the Korean government would cease all ICBM and nuclear all missile and nuclear tests in trade for the U.S. and South Korea to stop military exercises on the border.
Very important.
Which is what North Korea has all along demanded. That is essentially North Korea's, very reasonable. It's an unreasonable regime, but they have very reasonable national security requests for that.
Stop practicing an invasion with gazillions of assets twice a year against this. And, by the way, sign a peace treaty. That's their position.
Yeah. Russia and China, of course, are also concerned about the THAAD missile defense that is threat to both of their strategic deterrents being erected there, which it must be say the incoming prime minister of president of South Korea, Moon, is no big fan of the THAAD's installation, some of it in the middle of the night. Unannounced by the U.S. itself. So that's a very complicated situation there.
Yeah.
But all of this fed right into to this G20 meeting in Hamburg, and it was a big event. And, if Trump is any indication, he does make a lot of decisions based on personalities. Personal relationships matter very much to him. I would say that Trump has long held, a strong position in his imagination, repeatedly saying that him and Putin could be friends, that they could reach agreements, that, they would respect each other. But after everything that's happened in the last few months, there's every possibility that it could have ended up in an alpha dog contest. All indications are that they had good relations, good personal relations established in the first meeting, and the fact that we're already hearing this agreement coming out of it may be a first sign of de-escalation. It may be the first step on a path to détente. Of course, the U.S. establishment, the deep state, the foreign policy blob will do everything they can to derail this.
Mm-hmm.
And you can expect the media will be already leaping over conspiracies that might have arranged and that Trump is a Kremlin agent and all of this. This will all be reiterated tomorrow.
Yeah, they'll be doing that for a while. But, you know, we'll come back to this after this visit is in our rearview mirror. But I hope it's
a significant event, and let's see where it goes.
Exactly. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.